Welcome back, everybody. We're here again. Another episode of True Crime on Easy Street.
We're barely here.
Yeah, we are barely here today. So we apologize for that. You can blame Claudia.
Wow.
Yeah.
No.
We were all at a friend's daughter's wedding last night, a few miles down the road in Gadsden. Yeah. Alabama. So congratulations to Claudia and James.
Yes, congratulations. We're a little late with this. I know it's been a little.
Yeah, you're going to hear this at the end of the month.
This is part three of
a couple of weeks ago.
But nonetheless, it doesn't take away how sleepy we all are.
Sleepy, that's the word we'll use.
Sleepy.
Yeah, let's say sleepy today. My name is Scott Wright. I am a mediocre journalist.
I'm Kelly Turner. I'm not a doctor.
Katie Givens. I'm not a lawyer.
So have you guys been watching this show on Netflix that is all the rage called Baby Reindeer?
No.
Are you familiar with it?
I didn't even need you to say the name of the show to tell you no, I wasn't watching it because I've been watching nothing.
Okay.
I've never heard of this.
I've seen memes on and TikToks,
already,
but I don't know anything about it.
So right now, as we record on May the 12th, is that right? Anyway, you're listening
you're listening
2 weeks later.
We don't even
need
to throw out
names. It doesn't matter. Sorry. Yeah. Scratch that. Right now, this show, Baby Reindeer, that is on Netflix, is all in the news because it is based on a true story.
Oh.
And because a lot of people out there in the world don't have anything better to do, they are trying to get to the bottom of this true story, even though the guy who wrote the story and stars in the series has said, "That's not why I did this. I don't want you to try to figure out who these people are. I just wanted to tell my story." But it's turned into this internet sensation where everybody's trying to figure out who the real people are that are involved in this story that this guy is telling.
Is it a crime? Is it a love story?
It was a stalking case.
Oh, no.
This guy was being stalked by a woman.
Oh, interesting
twist. And he was also sexually assaulted by someone during the time that this story took place in his life.
Oh my goodness.
And so the internet has tried to figure out who the stalker is and who the person is that sexually assaulted him.
Well,
and it's turned into this thing.
I think we probably should figure that out because those are crimes.
I get it.
I mean, the police should figure that out, not the public.
I think it's already been put together.
And this is just the guy later telling the story, but now the internet is figuring out who these people actually are. It's turned into a thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I read somewhere in the article that I read that said probably compliance with the streaming services when they greenlight one of these projects that tells a true crime story.
Yeah.
They're going to make darn sure now that they've got their T's crossed and I's dotted, legally speaking, because now Netflix is going to get sued. This guy is probably going to get sued.
Well, is it a shocker to anybody in this room that people wanted to know who these people actually were?
Exactly.
Not to me.
No.
If you're telling a true story, I don't know what the grounds for suing is.
If you're going to flash up on the screen before the whole thing starts, this is a true story.
Oh my gosh. A lot of people are going to pause right there and probably just start searching away immediately.
Let me go grab my legal pad.
I want to see what these people actually look like in real life while I'm watching these people on the screen.
Yeah.
I do that.
Yeah, me too.
I mean, I think the lady has already, it will have happened a couple of weeks ago by now, but she has been interviewed by Piers Morgan.
Mm, okay.
The actual female who is the one who is accused of stalking.
Mm-hmm. Was she acquitted? Or was she
I don't know
convicted?
That it ever got to that point.
Okay, so there's some sort
legally
of settlement
speaking,
or something maybe? Or
I don't
a restraining
know.
Order?
I feel like I should. Now I feel like I should have read more before
well,
I brought this up.
Well, look into it. I'm interested in
Baby Reindeer.
Have you watched it?
I've watched the first episode, and it's
Scott
it's
loves
creepy.
To talk about a show he's seen about half an episode.
That's
of.
Right.
That is true.
Or he'll be like, "You've got to watch this," and then we'll watch the whole series and be like, "So, Scott, what'd you think of it?" Oh, I only watched the first episode.
Good Lord.
It's on the list now. I like to have three or four things started. Mm-hmm. And then whatever mood I'm in when I get home.
Watch it.
Watch that.
Yeah, because sometimes you want true crime. Sometimes you want something lighter.
Yeah.
I get that.
I hear that Sugar on Apple TV is really good. I haven't started it yet, but it stars Colin Farrell.
Okay.
And that's supposed to be really good.
Okay.
There's a twist. That's
like
all
it.
I'm saying.
Okay, I like
there's
a twist.
There's a twist.
I like a twist. That's always fun.
I hadn't heard of that one.
There's a twist in this one, so I'm told.
Well, in the spirit of looking up people and trying to figure out who the real people are, for this case that we've been talking about, I have looked up everybody. I have looked at all of their Facebook pages.
Right.
I have wasted so much time just going through trying to get a sense of who these people are in their personal everyday life.
You're the person that we've been trying to get to do that on this podcast.
Yeah.
You just did it to yourself.
I did.
There's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah.
Maybe someone else out there did the same thing, because this is a very interesting story. A lot of plot twists and moving parts.
I spent a lot of time on a lot of the different Facebook pages.
Yeah.
Looking at the different posts and the different comments and just trying to, you know, piece together. And then I had to stop what I was doing and then try and do it again without emotion involved and get a little bit of a different picture that way.
That was at 3 a.m. when you realized you'd been doing it for 8 hours straight. And the cornbread was burned in the oven.
I don't make
cornbread. The cat had passed out from lack of water.
No, she would have let me know a lot sooner. She lets you know. The dog is the one that will just sit there and quietly starve or thirst. The cat will.
KT has fallen in the floor and he's like a turtle and he can't get up because of his bad back.
Oh, God. So it was I willingly jumped headfirst down this rabbit hole this time. The first time I was looking into this case years ago, I was sort of pulled down the rabbit hole. This time I just went willingly.
Stepped right in it.
And I can't.
I know.
I think it's necessary, but I'm glad that this is our final episode.
Me
but I
too.
Think we've got some good talking points.
I do too. Yeah, I think we're going to have some good stuff today.
Yeah.
All right. So first of all, before we begin this episode, and this is the one that's going to wrap up our West Memphis May about the West Memphis Three.
Yes.
Let's make damn sure that we don't overlook the fact that there are three little boys
who died. Who were murdered.
Stephen Branch, Christopher Byers, Michael Moore. Those are the three little 8-year-old boys who were found murdered on May the 6th, 1993.
Oh, well, they found them on
Found
the
them
6th.
On the 6th, yeah. In this 4-acre wooded area adjacent to the interstate in West Memphis, Arkansas.
Yep.
For the next hour, we're going to debate and discuss whether or not we think Damien Echols and Jason Baldwin and Jesse Miss Kelly Jr. committed the crimes, or were three more victims of what happened that day in Robin Hood Hills.
Oh yeah.
So let's just be clear about that. We're gonna try to get to the bottom of this today.
There'll be a lot of my personal opinion today.
Yes. There's a quote from, you know, we talked earlier this week, Kelly, you and I, about that book that Dan Stidham wrote. And Dan Stidham was the guy who was the defense attorney for Jesse Miss Kelly Jr. in that first trial. He has written a book. It came out in 2023. It's called
A Harvest of Innocence.
Mm-hmm. And there's a quote in that book that I thought was a really good way to get everybody back up to speed on where we are in part 3.
Okay.
Here's the quote. Detectives would soon coerce and coach Jesse Miss Kelly Jr.'s confession and arrest him. Then they would bring in Damien Echols and Jason Baldwin. West Memphis, Arkansas was suddenly Salem, Massachusetts, revisited 300 years later. And these three young men charged with the crime became modern-day witches, convicted without any real evidence by people ready to take them to the stake to be burned.
Yes.
That's what happened.
Or there were a lot of people, but I don't know that the jury, everybody on the jury was in agreeance with that. I mean, I know they pled guilty, but... Or, you know, the jury misconduct. There was jury misconduct.
Yes.
By the foreman.
Nobody pled guilty.
By the right.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah.
The guilty verdicts. I know they delivered three guilty verdicts.
That's right.
But there was a lot of misconduct by, in particular, the foreman of the jury.
A couple of instances where the foreman of the jury, at one point, he talked to an attorney about the case.
Multiple times. And they, in the jury room during the Jason Baldwin and Damien Echols trial, they brought up the Jesse Miss Kelly confession.
Yeah.
And that was not supposed to be discussed because he didn't testify. They were not supposed to be able to use that.
But remember that everybody, there was no way that that was not going to be discussed, I think, because everybody knew about it.
Well,
because it had been leaked to the Memphis newspaper.
They went so far as to put it on a big giant board
Yeah, like where they were deliberating inside the jury room, pros and cons,
and
innocent, guilty.
It was in some of the jurors' notes.
Yeah. Everybody knew about it.
Yeah, and they actively discussed it, and that was pretty much the deciding factor, what a lot of them have said.
Yeah. So I went back and read Dan Stidham's book again this week. Did you read it or did you read the other one?
No, I...
Okay.
I
know you did a lot of research this week.
He was recently on a podcast and answered a lot of questions. So I listened to all of that this week.
Well, I went back and read it. And just a few of the revelations, the things that if you haven't dug into this case yet, here's some things that Dan Stidham, the guy who was Jesse Ms. Kelly Jr.'s defense attorney, and was really the only attorney... Sorry. I forgot to turn off my phone.
Was that Simon and Simon?
Yeah, that's the theme song from Simon and Simon. That's my ringtone.
We don't have the rights to that song, but that is Scott's ringtone.
I will call my friend Carlton back later. He's calling to tell me what happened yesterday at the Birmingham Stallions game, which he attended in Birmingham.
Okay.
Which is why they call them the Birmingham Stallions. I feel like I've gone over this.
Yep.
Anyway, a couple of revelations from the book that I went back and read. First of all, that confession from Jesse Ms. Kelly Jr., Judge David Burnett allowed that confession to be mentioned in the Ms. Kelly trial, even though Jesse Ms. Kelly Jr. had not been read his rights before he sat down for his interview with the police. And that's, you can't do that.
Nope.
That's grounds for anything that he says to be tossed out right there. But the judge in the case let the confession stand anyway.
Yep. We're going to love this judge before it's over with today.
And that is a direct violation of Arkansas State Constitution Rule 2.3.
Yep.
That's called a 2.3 violation.
Well, there you go.
You know, it's a 2.3 violation.
Seems like a pretty early rule there.
Yeah. Well,
that they really wanted you to know that one.
Even more maddening, when it got to the state Supreme Court, they said, don't worry about it.
Yeah.
Because it's up to the judge to decide whether or not the kid's going to be tried as an adult or a juvenile. And since the judge ruled that he was going to be tried as an adult, and here's why that happened, that's different.
Mm-hmm. And the reasoning for being tried as an adult, I think people can understand, is there are three murdered 8-year-old boys.
Yes.
So that I don't get too upset about trying someone as an adult when you look at the crime, but shouldn't you also look at the evidence there before you decide on that?
You would think so.
I don't know, though. I don't.
Yeah.
You obviously don't have to do that, but.
We talked about this last week. You mentioned the fact that Pam Hobbs, the mother of one of the little boys who was killed.
Yeah.
She was interviewed by a television reporter. It's featured in the first Paradise Lost film.
Yeah.
And you said, I think she was high when she gave that interview.
Very much.
Because she was.
And I did say
out of her mind.
I did say not that I blame her.
Oh, sure. Not at all.
But. Yeah.
Remember that TV reporter said, have you ever thought about committing suicide?
Yeah. The TV reporter asks this mother.
Live on the air for the 10 o'clock
have
news.
Have you ever thought about joining Stevie? Yeah. And then when she wasn't.
That's a wild thing to say.
Yeah. And then when she wasn't catching on to what he was saying, he said, have you thought about committing suicide? Why would you ask, what's the, as a journalist, Scott, what's the importance of that question?
What
are you trying to do?
You're a piece of crap journalist. Okay. You were lower than mediocre.
Yeah.
You're Geraldo Rivera. You're clickbait.
That's rough.
You're just trying for something that's going to be the lead story on the 10 o'clock news, to the point where Dan Stidham called that particular TV reporter maggot. That was the code name in the defense team for this particular TV reporter. It got so bad. This guy was so sensational in his reporting about the case, the trial, that Dan Stidham ended up putting him on his witness list to get him excluded from the courtroom.
That is fantastic.
Yeah.
And why I absolutely love Dan Stidham.
Yeah. So the reporter quit his job so that he could come to the trial every day because his intention was to write a book.
So he was
which he ended up not writing, according to Stidham, but that was what happened.
Good. I'm glad he never got that.
They hated that guy.
I don't like him at all myself. I don't even know the guy's name, and it's okay. I don't have to.
Yeah.
But
yeah, let's don't give him any publicity.
That's a very early clip of the very first Paradise Lost.
Yes.
Which is the HBO documentary. That's a 3-part documentary. They're several years apart.
Yeah. 96 for the first one. The second one, Paradise Lost, I forget the name
Is it?
The second one came out in 2000.
It's like Revelations.
Revelations.
Or something like that. Yeah.
And then the third one came out in 2012, and it told the story of what happened at the end of all of this.
Yeah, which we're getting to. Yeah. I'm sorry. I keep
No, that's fine.
But that one is called Purgatory.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the third one's Purgatory.
Yeah.
Dan Stidham's, he has a practice in his hometown. I forget the name of his hometown in Arkansas. It's 80 miles away from where this case happened. But his hometown forced him to resign as a Cub Scout master because they were all in an uproar that he had audacity to defend this guy who the entire state of Arkansas had already predetermined to be guilty before the trial ever began.
And Dan Stidham admits that he thought he was guilty too when he walked in. I did too. When I first looked at this case, I could not believe you would admit to something so heinous.
Who would confess to a crime they did not commit? Go back and listen to our Beatrice Six.
Yeah, it
episodes.
Turns out lots of people.
Lots
it
of
turns
people.
Out that's a thing that happens.
That is totally a thing. If you are listening to this and you haven't listened to last week's episode, we mentioned the three different kinds of false confessions as they are generally categorized.
Yep.
And I don't remember what they are now. That was a week ago and I don't have my notes. Go back and listen to the damn thing.
If you're listening to this and you haven't listened to parts one and two,
you're doing it wrong.
Go back. Go back and start with part one because you need to know what we're talking about. Yeah. We're picking up where we left off.
At one point, Dan Stidham released an analysis that he had paid for out of his own pocket by a polygraph expert that said that he believed that Jesse Ms. Kelly's confession was coerced. Mm-hmm. Judge David Burnett threatened Dan Stidham with contempt of court if he said anything else to the press for the entirety of the trial, although we've established plenty that the prosecution was allowed to say whatever they want, leak things to the press whenever they wanted. The confession got leaked.
Yeah.
I mean, this case was tainted. This case should have been moved to Wyoming.
I believe that the cops sold the confession to the newspaper.
Oh, I don't doubt it at all. A bunch of corrupt cops in Arkansas in the early 90s.
There was a news story where the lady's talking about the crime, and she comes out and says it. She said, we had a person call, a female voice, identifying themselves with the Arkansas, with the police,
right,
with the West Memphis, whatever, and tried to sell us the story. And she said, we do not pay for stories.
Mm. Now that's journalism. You don't pay for stories if you're a journalist.
And they
went
so far as to announce it on the nightly news.
Journalists don't pay for stories.
And then it was in the newspaper.
Unless you work the National Enquirer, and then sometimes you pay not to run a story. Or so it has been alleged.
Yeah.
At one point, the prosecution offered Jesse a reduced sentence of 50 years if he would testify against Eccles involved. But I think we mentioned that last week. But Jesse got to the point where he said, you know, I just can't tell any more lies.
Mm-hmm.
Simpleton Jesse Ms. Kelly Jr. at age 17 said, I can't do that anymore.
He refused to get on the stand during their trial. And then either before or as the trial's going on, they approach Jason Baldwin.
That's right. On two different occasions.
And the second time they approached him, they offered him 10 years, 10 years, if he would roll on Jesse Ms. Kelly. And he wouldn't
Damien
do
Eccles,
it.
If he would roll on Damien.
I'm so sorry. Yeah. I'm Damien Eccles. Yeah. I'm going to confuse everybody with the names. I'm so sorry. Mm-hmm. Jason refused because he was not going to lie on his friend. But also, what that tells you is that they were reeking of desperation.
Yes. Yeah.
And they had faith in the justice system at the time.
Oh, you're talking about Jason Baldwin
Eccles?
At
the time, they're not going to. We didn't do it. How can they possibly? Jason Baldwin said last week in that quote from him, I was raised to believe that nothing like this could happen in the United States of America.
Yeah, well, talk about it entirely too much on this podcast that this does happen.
So there were a lot of things in Katie may be able to explain this. There's a word, it's called a proffer. And what happened a lot of times in this case, Judge David Burnett would not allow the defense to introduce things into evidence. But they could attach this evidence to the court record so that when an appellate judge heard it later, they could rule in part on whether or not Judge Burnett should have allowed this testimony or this evidence to be admitted into the trial to begin with. So there are a lot of cases or a lot of points in this case where they submitted proffers to their defense case.
Yeah, it's just like a, but, it's an offer of proof.
But
yeah.
The problem with that is every time they came around for an appeal, it's Judge Burnett.
That's
again.
Right.
Again,
that was
every
one of the
single time.
I don't understand how the Arkansas justice system works. In
how is
the
that
fact,
legal?
I don't know how your trial judge is also your appellate judge.
Every single time. Every single time.
Was he still a trial judge at this point, or had he been appointed to the Court of Appeals at this point?
No, he was still like a circuit judge.
How is this possible that it keeps coming back to this man's desk? And they're doing all of this work, showing all of this. He knows what he's going to do before he sees it.
That's right.
And there were rumors.
That's what happens.
According to Dan Stidham, in an interview that he did with a podcast called True Crime Garage, according to him, he says that there were rumors that he postponed his Senate run until these appeals had,
Judge David Burnett.
Yeah.
Right.
Until these appeals had passed his desk, and then he moved on.
Yeah.
But I don't, you know, there's no proof of that for sure, but, you know.
Well, it turns out that one of the first things that should have happened when David Burnett announced his run for state Senate, he should have automatically recused himself from the trial. And at one point, Dan Stidham asked him to recuse himself from the trial because he had declared his run for the state Senate. Judge David Burnett refused to do that. But that later turned out to be grounds for an appeal right there.
Mm-hmm.
Just that one thing alone.
That one thing.
That he improperly did that. And Judge David Burnett did a lot of things improperly.
Why was he so in cahoots with the prosecution? Was he using this to get elected to the Senate? Like, look what
I think
I've
you could
here.
Certainly argue that. Okay. Judge David Burnett was a former prosecutor. And what Dan Stidham says in his book is that Burnett always still considered himself, in a sense, to be a prosecutor, even when he sat on the bench, because a lot of times, or on occasion, Judge Burnett would take over the interrogation of a witness from the bench.
Which a judge can ask witness questions. That's not weird. But
okay. Apparently, Judge Burnett liked to do it a lot.
But it is weird for a judge to still consider himself a prosecutor.
He's very in that mindset. Still.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which now, a lot of judges are former prosecutors. It's just kind of things go. But.
And then Dan Stidham is now a judge.
Yeah, he became a judge while this was all happening.
And he is
an elected local judge.
He is. And he, you know, having that defense background, mm-hmm. of course, he's going to, you know, mm-hmm. he believes he's better suited.
Yeah.
Because he doesn't have, right. he wasn't a prosecutor, yeah. you know. I don't know. I mean, you could argue that either way. And I think it depends on the person. But I do think that Dan Stidham is probably a better judge than Burnett.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'd rather have him than Burnett.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah,
I think I'd rather have anybody.
Yeah. No kidding. Damian Echols.
It's really rough to watch and then really rough to see all the appeal process.
Yeah. I can't
come across his desk and get denied and trying to submit new evidence and denied. And, you know, in 2000 and was it 2007 when the new evidence came?
Yes, that's right.
Out, he denies it.
Denies it. Denied a new trial based on new DNA technology and new DNA evidence.
Which they had.
That would end up being that hair that was in the ligatures of one of the boys that matched one of the other boys' stepfather.
So,
and we'll talk about Terry Hobbs today.
Yeah. So let me explain that a little bit, because when I hear that, I think, oh my God, you got him.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Red-handed. But what that actually means is there was a hair on one of the ligatures that tied up the Moore.
Michael Moore.
Michael Moore, who is not related to Terry Hobbs.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
And according to Dan Stidham, it was Michael Moore's own shoelaces.
Yeah.
So, because there was some conversation about, well, it could have been a shoelace from Stevie Branch, and then you have transfer hair, you know, that sort of thing. But he said it was Michael Moore's shoelaces, his own shoelaces. The hair, what the hair was able to do was exclude Damian Echols, Jason Baldwin, Jesse Miss Kelly.
That's right.
It did not match any of them.
And that was their argument in asking for a new trial. And like you've already said, Judge Burnett said, not
denied
enough.
It. But they can narrow it down to 1.1% of the population with that hair.
Mm.
There's 30,000 people in this area.
Right.
So 300 people.
Mm.
And Terry Hobbs could have been one of them.
Yeah.
So that's what the evidence says. So what this defense team is saying is we have enough evidence to tell you that our guys are innocent.
Mm-hmm. The reasonable doubt. Three.
Yeah. But we're not saying there's enough evidence to convict Terry Hobbs on this.
That's not our job. We're trying to get our guys off. You figure out who did it, and here's some evidence for you.
Here you go. Here's this. But they're not trying to say, look, Terry Hobbs did it. Mm-hmm. You know, because at one point in time, Damian Eccles was pointing the finger at John Mark Byers.
That's right.
When we talked about the knife, the bloody knife.
The stepfather of Christopher Byers, one of the victims.
Who gave HBO a knife that had blood on it. Mm-hmm. And then he became the target, which Damian Eccles later walked that back and said that he was sorry for doing that. He was doing the same thing to John Mark Byers that was done to him.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And the two of them ended up becoming friends.
At the very least,
wow.
John Mark Byers became a staunch defender of the West Memphis Three and said, they're not supposed to be in jail. I believe that, and I hated those kids because the state of Arkansas told me that they did it.
Yep.
But now I know that the state of Arkansas is full of shit.
Yep.
And I don't think they did it.
John Mark Byers.
Somebody else did it.
Yeah. John Mark Byers is all in.
Well, he was.
Paradise Lost.
Yeah.
He was in one and two as ready for them to die, wanting to kill them immediately. You can understand that. Mm-hmm. With this terrible crime to his son. At the time, they were talking about the sexual mutilation.
Yeah.
His son was the only one that had been, whether they were saying emasculated.
This speaks to what John Mark Byers said. I believe what the state of Arkansas told me, because everything that you just rattled off was part of the prosecution's case in that trial of Damian Eccles and Jason Baldwin, and it all turned out to not be true.
Correct. New experts, actual experts, mm-hmm. came in. Mm-hmm. And looked at, they had the top forensic researcher in the world.
Yeah, if you know anything about true crime, you've heard of Michael Baden. He's the forensic doctor.
Guru.
Has done tens of thousands of autopsies. If you've watched a true crime story that involved an autopsy, mm-hmm. it probably had Michael Baden in it somewhere.
Yes. So he takes a look at this, and what he says is there actually wasn't sexual mutilation on Christopher Byers, that once they were killed and left out in the woods, thrown out in the water, animals.
That's right.
It was all from animals. There were claw marks on them. Those were not knife wounds.
Yeah, that wasn't.
Was no knife wound.
That wasn't a drag a wound from a serrated knife edge.
Right. It was
a claw.
Scratch marks.
So when you take all of that out, it's still a terrible crime. It's mm-hmm. still an awful crime, but it puts it in a little bit more perspective of, okay, wait a minute. That might change the game a little bit about who do we think did this.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm.
You asked me this yesterday when we were texting back and forth about what it was that Dan Stidham had on Judge Burnett.
Yeah.
At one point that was grounds for possibly a mistrial, and here it is. So after the case had been handed to the jury in the Jesse Miss Kelly trial, the first trial, mm-hmm. the jury got the case on an afternoon. They deliberated until midnight and said, we need to come back tomorrow. So the judge let him go home. They come back the next day. They start at 9:30 that morning. Lunchtime rolls around. They still haven't said anything. So the judge and the prosecutor and Dan Stidham, the three of them go, and he knocks on the door, the judge does, of the jury room. The jury foreman comes to the door. And the judge says, hey, I'm about to order lunch. What do you guys want for lunch today? And the jury foreman said, I don't think we're going to need lunch. We're just about finished here. At which point Judge Burnett said to him, well, you're still going to have to sentence him after you convict him.
Oh.
So I'm going to go ahead and order lunch. Today's episode is brought to you in part by A&W Outdoor Services, located right here in Cherokee County, Alabama. It's almost time to tidy up the deck, clean the gutters, and spruce up the yard and landscaping around your home, lake house, or creekside cabin. And who better to do that for you than the professional crew at A&W Outdoor Services? Call 256-706-7964 and let Alan and his crew do all the hard work for you so you can spend your time this summer enjoying your piece of Cherokee County in clean, carefree comfort. Call Alan today for a free estimate or to get on the A&W spring schedule before it's full. That's A&W Outdoor Services at 256-706-7964.
Hey, guys. Do you know what time it is?
Tell us.
It's time to plan your best vacation ever, right here in beautiful Cherokee County, Alabama.
Many outdoor adventures await. You can wet a hook in beautiful Weiss Lake, swing away at Cherokee Pines Golf Club, climb to the best view around at Cherokee Rock Village, hike the Little River Canyon National Preserve, take a day's long splash at Pirates Bay Water Park, and there's so much more.
The Cherokee County Chamber of Commerce and Tourism has a full list of recommended lodging facilities, RV sites, and campgrounds, and they're all set up to suit your vacation needs, whatever they may be.
So come see us from wherever you are located. And if you already live right here in Cherokee County, then plan your summer staycation with the Chamber by visiting cherokee-chamber.org.
It's insane.
Wow.
So,
and the foreman,
Dan Stidham, is flabbergasted.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Point. Absolutely.
Now he wants the same tattoo that Jesse Minskelly has. WTF.
Yeah.
Actually, he was FTW, but anyway, same three letters.
So
that's grounds for a mistrial right there. But mm-hmm. Dan Stidham and his fellow counsel, they're so convinced that Minskelly's going to walk free that they don't want to risk an innocent verdict mm-hmm. by asking for a mistrial.
Right.
And Judge Burnett's not going to give him the damn mistrial anyway.
No.
Because he's his own police officer at this point.
Yes.
So they don't ask for the mistrial. Mm-hmm. And that backfires. But that's something that is used against, that is used in the appeals process later.
And Dan Stidham actually testifies and admits to being an inappropriate representative of Jesse Minskelly. He actually falls on the sword and says, these are the things that I did wrong.
Yeah, and I think I said last week that he was 27 years old, Dan Stidham. He was 30 when this happened, according to his
own. Still a young lawyer.
Yeah, first ever
it was his first
capital
ever
murder trial.
Yes. Well, what judge orders lunch? You don't have somebody to do that for you?
If you think, right? But if you think about it, what he was doing, he wanted to...
I'm just saying that's more proof of what he's
absolutely
making. He was making
that
sure...
That was a blatant attempt to find out what's going on in the jury room.
And to make sure it turned out the way he wanted it to.
Yes, for him to say, I was going to order... When has that man ever ordered
his
own
order
lunch?
He don't order his own lunch.
Yeah.
He don't order his own lunch. He doesn't.
Just another instance
I've dealt with enough judges over the years. They don't order their own lunch.
I know.
Putting his thumb on the scale.
I was telling Emily Allen yesterday, she's at Auburn pre-law, and she's talking about wanting to go to law school and wanting to come to the office and shadow. And I was like, if you're wanting to do that, you're going to have to get in contact with me because Shane's never going to schedule that. Nothing against you. He just doesn't do his own scheduling.
No. Not going to happen.
Not going to happen.
So then you have the jury foreman. I'm going to go back to him a little bit.
Yeah, sure.
And in one of the documentaries, she was a secretary for the lawyer that he had contacted, I believe. Was she a secretary or a paralegal or something? But she, at the time, she was no longer working for this lawyer. And there was this affidavit of jury misconduct going on. It was sealed. Mm-hmm. He couldn't talk about it, but she could. Mm-hmm. And she talked a lot. Mm-hmm. And she said that he came to the office multiple times, the jury foreman. They didn't know he wasn't the foreman at the time, but he had been summoned to jury duty.
Okay.
He knew he was going to be doing this.
Yeah.
And he's talking to them about it, and he's already convicted them. He already knew. Mm-hmm. He had seen the paper
with the confession.
And then he goes through, and the lawyer that he talks to really doesn't answer his questions a whole lot, but just kind of says, well, he'll get excluded, and tells him you'll get marked off when they do jury selection.
As soon as they ask you what you think and you tell them the truth, what you just told me, they're going to kick you right out of the room.
Well, then he comes back and he's on the jury and he says that it was the questions that the lawyers didn't ask. Mm-hmm. He skirted around it with his answers because they didn't ask him the quote right questions. And then he turns out he becomes the foreman. And she said, we were flabbergasted mm-hmm. when he says he's the jury foreman. So he was already tainted.
Yeah. Oh, totally.
And when they first voted for Jesse Minskelly, what did it turn out, Scott?
The first vote, Dan Stidham found out years later, the county sheriff that was there at the time got in touch with Stidham years later and said, you know what? The first vote was the sheriff told him it was 4-4 acquittal. Mm-hmm. Stidham found out later that it was actually 5-5 acquittal.
For
the first time they took a straw poll in the jury room, 5 are going to vote to acquit. So the theory is that they were persuaded, they knocked the charges down from capital murder mm-hmm. to first degree murder for Michael Moore and second degree murder for the other two boys, mm-hmm. it makes it look like that was the happy medium that they found in the jury room to convince the acquittal votes mm-hmm. to change mm-hmm. their vote.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the reason it was first degree for Michael Moore is because in the story that Jesse gives, he says that Michael takes off running and mm-hmm. he goes and gets him and brings him back.
That's right.
So their thought process was Michael Moore would still be alive had you yeah. not chased him down.
Yeah.
But turns out Jesse was not in the woods with those kids.
Nope.
Neither was Damien Eccles no. or Jason Baldwin. That's because right. there's absolutely zero DNA there. The only physical evidence they found there links Terry Hobbs, which is Stevie Branch's stepfather. Well, I've already talked about yeah. how that works.
Yeah, yeah, he's it's the not only just person's him, DNA that has mm-hmm. ever been found. That
definitely excludes those three.
Yeah.
Stidham was also very frustrated because he wanted Jason Baldwin's lawyers to kind of follow the way he did and sort of try to give the jury, you know, if you can give them something a little less
yeah.
or separate the two and not try them together, because the only reason Jason Baldwin gets convicted is because of Damien Eccles. Damien Eccles gets to take the stand and doesn't mm-hmm. really do that great of a job.
No, he doesn't.
And they never hear anything come out of Jason Baldwin's mouth until at his sentencing, they ask him, do you want to say anything to the families? And he says, I'm innocent.
Right.
I don't know why Damien Eccles was on that stand. Who thought that was a good idea?
Yeah.
There were things he did good with, but for mm-hmm. the most part, he just was not good.
Just a good rule of thumb.
Well, what he had going against him, Damien Eccles, was the fact that he was a weirdo.
Yeah.
Yes.
And that comes out no matter what. You don't have to talk for Damien Eccles, talk to him for very long for the weirdo part to come out.
Not at all.
And that was the prosecution's case.
Yeah.
He's guilty because he's a weirdo. So if he goes up and confirms he's a weirdo, mm-hmm. which is exactly what he did.
And the documentary series is interviewing one of the prosecutors, and he says, you know, wearing black is not a problem in and of itself.
Yeah.
And I'm...
Yeah.
Well, yeah. I'm sitting here...
You're guilty. You're wearing all black today.
I have a black t-shirt, black shorts, and black shoes on mm-hmm. today.
You did it.
I did it on purpose.
In Arkansas, you did.
But I would do it. I wear this most of the time.
Yeah.
But then he says, and listening to heavy metal music is not a problem in and of itself. But mm-hmm. when you put the two together, then you have a problem.
What?
He says that.
What?
He says that.
Oh, yeah.
What sense does that make?
And I never for one second.
Satanic panic.
Could I take seriously the quote doctor, the mail order doctor, who is the occult specialist? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, Judge Burnett didn't have a problem with that occult specialist, remember? He let him testify.
Laughable. Yeah, that guy's laughable.
A degree didn't matter?
He said, as far as I'm concerned, you don't have to have a degree to be an expert in any given
No, you can
field.
Have a third grade education.
And as far as I'm concerned, he's an expert, so he gets to testify.
Yeah. This guy is a clown. Not the occult expert
yeah.
guy
yeah.
is a clown.
Yeah, mail order PhD was...
Mail order. He took zero classes for yeah. his master's degree and zero classes for his PhD. Mm-hmm. He mailed in some money and a form and... Yeah. was given a certificate to be an expert in the occult.
I know. I'm mad. I didn't know you could just order a degree over I'm here mad wasting too. All my time in school.
All these
Think of the money
loans.
We could have saved.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
So another thing that Dan Stidham tells in his book is that when the trial was over, Jesse Miskelly's trial, remember they tried him first.
Yes. Right.
And then they tried Eccles and Baldwin together. So when Miskelly is found guilty and he's put into the patrol car to be taken to state prison, Stidham knocks on the door. On the window, the cop rolls it down and says, don't talk to my client. Don't try to get him to say anything. Don't talk to him on this 3-hour drive up to wherever you're taking him to state prison. You can't talk to him without me here, so don't. Well, guess what?
Oh, they talked to him the whole time.
The whole time. Mm-hmm.
But he's already been convicted.
That probably yeah. made them
well, they're trying to, they're trying to get him to confess. I'm sorry. They're trying to get him to testify.
Mm-hmm. Against the other two,
Eccles and Baldwin.
I don't think
because
you have a right to. I don't think that that's breaking any rules. I think you're.
I don't know
I
that
think
it
your
is.
Right to an attorney has ended after that conviction.
I got you.
Possibly,
and maybe so.
Like, he's in their possession now. I mean, basically, he's owned by them now.
Because, like,
point.
You also don't have a right to a speedy sentencing hearing.
No, you don't.
So I,
once that's, you've been convicted.
Yeah, once right. you've been convicted. So that's why I'm thinking, I don't think that Which the is right a to little, your attorney to be there is.
It's a little ludicrous to me that mm-hmm. you don't have a right to speedy sentencing.
Yep.
Yeah.
That's kind of strange.
Well, at the time of this case, and this was back in the 90s, but I remember reading that Arkansas was one of only five states at the time that still had this bifurcated trial process where one aspect of the trial is guilt or innocence. Mm-hmm. And then there's another aspect of the trial where evidence can still be submitted to the court to determine the mm-hmm. length of the sentence. Mm-hmm. And there were only five states and it didn't list the other four, but Arkansas was one of those. And it made it sound like that
where
has since been changed.
You can still present evidence mm-hmm. after the trial. After the,
yeah, so then
you can present evidence at sentencing. Yeah,
so then that can make it, wow. Yeah. It just really
I'm
stacks the deck.
Arkansas has a judicial system at this point.
I'm not either.
Well, think about the cases we've talked about in Arkansas.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Sorry, listeners in Arkansas.
Yeah, I know. Right. I mean, we have no problem with Arkansas, no, but yeah. I probably
we feel
won't,
bad for you.
Yeah. I mean, like, yeah.
There's a great movie from about 5 or 6 years ago. It stars John Lithgow and Liam Helmsworth, Chris Helmsworth's brother.
This is a terrible movie. Quit.
It's a fantastic movie. It's called Arkansas. Watch it. It's a crime movie.
Horrible.
And it takes place in Arkansas. Really, Katie?
Horrible.
Oh, I love it. I've watched it like five times. I think it's terrific.
I watched it because of all the things I've watched that you suggested.
Why did you start there?
I don't know, Scott. But it was terrible. I didn't finish it.
It was not terrible.
I could not finish it.
Okay.
It was a great movie.
I'm probably not going to watch it.
See, Katie missed the ball on this. Anyway, so what happens in between the time that Jesse Miss Kelly is convicted and the time that the Eccles Baldwin trial begins, there is a full court press on by the prosecutors to get Miss Kelly to testify because there's a scene in Paradise Lost, the first one, where the prosecutors, Fogelman and Brent Davis, are telling the families of the three dead little boys, look, we're going to have to make a deal with Jesse Miss Kelly because we don't really have a lot to go on with these guys. It's 50-50 if we can even convict them.
Yes. Mm.
They say that in the movie. That's documented.
Yeah, one of the prosecutors, the one with the beady little eyes.
Oh, that's Brent Davis, and I don't like
that
guy.
No lips, and it's like, God. And I'm thinking, Kelly, stop. I had to really try to take emotion out, but it's really impossible to take that out of this story.
That guy is easy to dislike. If there's anybody who is as slimy a snake in this case as the judge himself, it's that prosecutor.
And like a snake, he doesn't have lips.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Mm.
So this cat and mouse game ensues to the point where at one point Dan Stidham tells in his book, just days before the second trial is going to begin, without him being notified, they bring Jesse Miss Kelly the 3 hours back from jail or from prison and put him in the local jail where this trial is going to take place. And this trial there's been a change of venue granted, so it's not in West Memphis, but it's 80 miles away, wherever it is. They bring Jesse Miss Kelly to the local jail and leak it to the press so that the press will report that Miss Kelly is back in town to testify against Baldwin and Eccles, even though he wasn't, right? He's not.
Yeah.
And see, it just reeks of desperation. And they do a lot of these tactics.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember years ago, the first time I watched this documentary, I remember saying to myself, the prosecution knows they've got it wrong.
Oh, yeah.
They know. They're just digging in.
This ball's rolling downhill.
And they're just going to keep going. And they're just as surprised by the verdict as everybody else is.
Wow. Holy shit. We did it.
Look at us go.
That's exactly what happened.
I mean, there is nothing you can tell me that would make me believe that they knew that was going to be a conviction because they were just desperate. The whole knife thing, we talked about that previously behind Jason Baldwin's home. And there wasn't a knife.
Yeah. No, there was no knife at all, it turns out.
Yeah. Another thing that was shocking to me in watching those documentaries is I don't think people realize how, you know, you see Damien Eccles' face when you think about this case. Mm-hmm. He's the first face you see.
Yes.
The biggest face on the picture. Mm-hmm. And it's because he was the one who was given the death penalty.
Mm-hmm.
But I wasn't ready for how young Jason Baldwin looks.
Yeah.
I know he's 16 years old.
He looks 13.
He has 12. A baby face. I have a 14-year-old son, and if you stood him beside 16-year-old Jason Baldwin, you would think that my son was older.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And when they're,
oh yeah,
I'm, you know, cuffing him and putting him in the back of that cop car. And I know that he is headed to big boy prison.
Mm-hmm.
It breaks your heart.
Yeah.
It's awful.
And I remember seeing the scene at the end of the first Paradise Lost film when they say, "Do you have anything to say?" And Jason Baldwin, somebody is going to let me talk.
Mm-hmm.
Because his lawyer has told him the whole time, "We're going to hide in the shadows, let Damien Eccles take all the heat, and maybe they won't even convict you." And like we've already mentioned, the prosecution has come to him twice and said, "Hey, first time, 20 years. Mm-hmm. Second time, 10 years. Just roll over and testify against your friend. He's the one we want." So they already know this.
Mm-hmm.
So they think maybe if they just hide, they'll get out of here unscathed. So they keep him quiet. So finally, the judge is going to let him say something. And all he can say is, "Because I'm innocent."
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't know how you aren't jumping up and down on the table screaming it.
Right. Well, it turns out a lot of people,
because I would be.
Because from the first two documentaries of Paradise Lost, and then all the years that passed between the second one and the third one, mm-hmm. a lot of people with a lot of money did jump up and down
yeah.
and start screaming.
That's right.
And you've got people like Peter Jackson, who was the director of the Lord of the Rings trilogy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You've got Johnny Depp.
Mm-hmm.
You've got Natalie Maines.
Eddie Vedder.
Natalie Maines is the part of the Chicks mm-hmm. now.
Lead singer. The Chicks.
Mm-hmm. Eddie Vedder. There was
Pearl Jam.
Rumor. Yeah, the lead singer. I just assume everybody knows who he
yeah,
is.
Yeah, my bad.
Yeah, that's my yeah. fault.
No, no, it's okay.
Because, you know, I like. Again, I'm glad I wasn't in Arkansas
yeah,
you've in
been right
1993. But
and that's that movie. They all got together. I mean, they were all part of that movie West of Memphis
West
that Peter
Memphis.
Jackson mm-hmm. Helped to produce
yes.
in 2012. And it kind of tells the story. It goes back and retells this entire story.
Mm-hmm.
But what you get in the 2012 movie, because of what happened in August in 2011, is we finally get a conclusion. And it's a conclusion that everybody can live with, but nobody's happy with.
Nobody's happy with it. And they talk about Terry Hobbs a lot in
yeah.
that one.
They He's
really
kind
go
of
after
the focus
him.
As a suspect.
They go after him. And the reason, what comes out of that is he sues Natalie Maines.
That's right.
For defamation of character. Terry Hobbs mm. does. But what that does is it opens him up to being...
being deposed. Yeah, he gets deposed.
Turns out he lies about a lot that mm. he did on that day.
Yeah, there's a lot of confusion about exactly where he was and who he spent time with.
Mm-hmm.
Part of the interview is with a guy who Terry Hobbs claims to have been with for part of that evening.
Who says, not that
I don't
time.
Really remember no. it that way. No. And that's when we see John Douglas, the FBI profiler
mm-hmm.
of true crime fame.
John Douglas is the person who wrote Mindhunter.
Yeah.
He is part of the team that coined the phrase serial killer.
Mm-hmm.
He is.
They were
the
first
FBI.
Ever behavioral analysis team for the Federal Bureau of Investigation back in the 70s.
He is an actual expert
yes.
without a mail.
We've talked about him
brochure.
Plenty of times, yeah. including
yeah,
when
we
did.
We used to talk about him a lot.
Yeah, yeah. Including when we did the Atlanta child murders because they've yes. the FBI was involved in that. And if
yep.
you watch that series Mindhunter on Netflix, it's based on.
Yep.
These true stories.
Yeah. John Douglas believes that the children were murdered by someone that they knew.
Mm-hmm.
John Douglas believes that it was not, murder was not the intent, that it was intended to scare them. And like a, almost
Something.
Like a barbaric punishment tactic.
Yeah.
That went wrong.
Like, what does he think that they made these boys get naked and tied them up and then they died?
Shame. Mm-hmm. And then,
yeah.
Well, they had bruises. So beating. Mm-hmm. And then,
they were all hit over the head.
And then eventually, yeah. Just,
but that maybe was a result of maybe one of them somehow it's taken too far and one boy dies.
Well, and Chris Byers didn't have water in his lungs. So
right.
Then the theory would be that it was taken too far with him.
And then they all had
And then he killed the other two.
And in a panic, toss everybody yeah. in the water, toss the bikes in the water. You go home and you change clothes because it's documented in West of Memphis that morning when Terry Hobbs left the house, he's wearing a purple tank top and a pair of shorts.
Mm-hmm.
And when Pam Hobbs comes home that evening.
Or when he picks her up, he goes to
When
pick
he picks her up.
Her up,
he is wearing a long sleeve shirt and blue jeans. But I get that part because he's been out looking for his kid, right? And somebody else says, well, we all were looking
in the woods
and it's the middle of May in Arkansas.
And the mosquitoes were terrible.
On the edge of the Mississippi River. The mosquitoes were awful. John Mark Byers said the same thing. When I realized I was going to go out in the woods to look for my kid, I went home and changed clothes.
And so that's, to be fair, that makes sense.
Yeah.
But we also have a suspect or a witness who says that Terry Hobbs did, in fact, she could place Terry Hobbs and the boys together about 6 or 6:30 that night.
And he says he didn't see them all day.
He says he was adamant in his deposition, I didn't see them all day.
Mm-hmm.
And she remembered it because May 5th was a Wednesday. And she was leaving. And the reason she knew it was a Wednesday and can attest to the time is because she was leaving her home to go to Wednesday night church.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
So she was able to tie it to...
Yeah, an event. Yeah.
Actual things that were going on, which is why she was able to remember it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I believe her testimony because of being able to tie it to those things. If she couldn't, I might say, well, maybe she's misremembering. Maybe it was another day.
Right.
But again, that doesn't convict Terry Hobbs. That does not mean that Terry Hobbs brutally murdered those three boys.
But it casts reasonable doubt.
There's reasonable doubt there.
On the three who have been wrongly convicted.
What it tells you is the three who have been in jail at this point for 17, 18 years should never have gone.
God, that's such a long time.
And the only reason that they were even on the FBI's list or the list of the prosecution is because of in a desperate attempt to not do police work, they reached out to all of those folks and said, give me a list of people you think might have done this or have done this.
Yeah.
That's lazy.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So they're getting this list from this juvenile probation officer. And that's how they get on his list. Scott went through all of those details in earlier episodes about this. And then here we go. We're on this crazy roller coaster. There was also another celebrity that it is rumored to have been a part of the financial backing for Damien Echols, but you don't really see them put together until after Damien Echols is free, and that was Marilyn Manson. And, the rumor is that Marilyn Manson, I can't think of what his actual name is, but he said, I'm going to just quietly support your cause.
Yeah.
Because they're going to jump all over.
Sure.
If I'm, you know, associated with you, then it's not a good thing.
Yeah. Marilyn Manson's name got dropped a lot in the lead up to this trial because he was just another excuse that the prosecution used to point and say, this is one of these, this is another circumstantial reason for why we're going to try to convince you that they did it.
But also that band is not even a band that Damien Echols lists.
No.
When he talks about the bands that he likes, he talks about Metallica. He talks about Megadeth. He throws U2 in there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
We know what Satanists they are, you know.
Speaking of that probation officer that you mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
In February of 1997, he was placed on administrative leave when an audit of his office found a $30,000 shortfall. He resigned the following month. Oh, wait, it gets worse. 3 years later, he pleaded no contest to the charges in the courtroom of Judge David Burnett.
Oh my gosh.
Who gave him a suspended sentence of 10 years. I'm sorry, gave him 10 years probation and ordered him to repay the missing money in installments of $241 per month.
Where did he come up with that number, for one? For two, where is he taking this money from? Like, how does he...
It's like his department's budget, I guess. Like, if he has a county budget or a state budget he has taken, somehow he's managed to...
He's a thief.
To infiltrate, or what is the word I'm looking for?
He's a thief.
Yeah, he's a thief. That's it.
That's where I'm going with that.
Yeah.
A dirty damn thief.
Just another example of what we've talked about several times on the show, the crookedness level of law enforcement in the state of Arkansas in the late 80s and early 90s, apparently.
I'm trying to figure out, what do these folks have on each other that they are just this thick as thieves? Like, what the heck is going on there?
Oh, and remember the The governor of the state of Arkansas that I mentioned last week, who offered to allow the Arkansas State Police to come in and help the West Memphis Department, mm-hmm. and they said no because they were being investigated. The governor, the guy who followed Bill Clinton in office, mm-hmm. who was the governor at the time, he ended up having to resign in 1996 because he was stealing money.
Wow.
From the top down in
Arkansas.
Do we just think that Bill just wasn't caught while he was there?
More and more all the time. I just think when they call him Slick Willie, I'm really starting to believe it. It's really, a little too late now.
He's a really Slick Willie, but yeah. So anyway.
Too soon.
I know. Sorry. So anyways, we're seeing all of this corruption, and everybody's screaming it from the rooftops, and all of these experts are coming in and with all of this money that's being brought in by these mm-hmm. people who have
to try and keep this case alive. Because remember, Damien Eccles and Jason Baldwin and Jesse Miskelly Jr., they're indigent. They're from poor families. They don't have the means to pay for these high powered attorneys.
No.
But because of the Paradise Lost trilogy and this other attention that has been drawn to them, there are people trying to help them because they see an injustice and they want to right what they consider to be a great injustice.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And it is.
So there are several appeals that work their way up to the state Supreme Court. Some of them fall in the boys' favor. Most of them don't.
Yeah.
But finally, mm-hmm. in 2010, there is an appeal. There's this pile of circumstantial evidence pointing in the opposite direction now. Mm-hmm. It goes all the way to the Arkansas State Supreme Court. And the Arkansas State Supreme Court remands the case back down to guess who?
Judge David Burnett.
And says, you need to consider all of this and possibly grant these guys a new trial date.
And what does he do?
Well,
so they didn't remand it for a new trial. They just sent it back for that judge to decide whether
it was
going to be a new
trial.
And they
said, you need to look at this.
Here's a bunch of reasons why we think you need to look at this again, because you've already denied this request for a new trial. Mm-hmm. But we think you need to look at it again.
And what does he do?
Usually, well, a Supreme Court would hand down a ruling that says that they remand it for a new trial based on
Was going to be a hearing.
We're getting there. It's just going to take a minute. Okay.
So this hearing was going to take place in December of 2011. That was what the Supreme Court had said to the circuit court. You gotta call a hearing and publicly announce whether or not you're going to do this. Before that, that's when Judge Burnett announces he's going to run for the state Senate.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess he gets elected.
He does. He gets elected. Woohoo.
Yeah. Because everybody involved in this case on the prosecution team, John Fogelman became a judge, an elected judge.
Oh my gosh. I'm sure he was great.
Yeah. Burnett goes to the state Senate.
He served a term or two or a while.
I think
And then in the third time, he just got murdered in the not murdered. That's a terrible word.
Yeah.
He got a lot outvoted.
What a choice of word.
Yeah.
He got a lot outvoted.
Burnett was at the time, and another reason for that I think is because Burnett was a Democrat at the time,
and the state of Arkansas was flipping into Republican. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That had something to do.
It probably had more to do with it than this.
Probably,
I would say.
Yeah, because he was pretty popular with the voters of Arkansas. Who didn't know the details of this story or didn't care to hear them. Yeah. They just knew that three people had been found guilty of this murder. Somebody confessed. Mm-hmm. And like we said last week, that's it. You're done.
Yeah.
And that's what happened. But anyway, so Burnett announces the run for state Senate.
Mm-hmm. And so they give it to another judge.
And another judge gets the case. And in between the time that announcement is made by the Supreme Court and when this hearing is supposed to take place in December, in August of 2011, some of these high-powered attorneys who have been hired with some of this money that is being generated by these people who are appalled.
Well-to-do. Yes.
They find an attorney in San Francisco. It doesn't matter. But he is a high-powered, he's really good at these appeals.
Mm-hmm.
So they get, this is going to happen. And he starts working on something that is called an Alford plea.
It's an Alford plea.
Alford plea.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what they end up convincing the three guys to do.
Mm-hmm.
Because... yeah, we can take a chance and try this case again. We think the new judge is going to give you this new trial date.
Mm-hmm. And everything was pointing in the direction that he would have.
Yeah, and Stidham
says
in his book.
This judge was different.
Yeah, Stidham, yes.
This judge was...
Everybody was relieved that finally Burnett had moved on.
Yeah.
I'll bet Dan Stidham voted for David Burnett just to try to get him off this case.
Probably to get him out. I'll campaign for you just to get you out of here.
But finally what happens is they decide they're going to, instead of take the risk of trying the case again, even though they feel really good about what might happen if they get back into the courtroom because of all these revelations, they convinced the three boys, Eccles, Baldwin, and Miss Kelly. And Baldwin was last.
Last.
He did not want to do this. Mm-mm. But he accepts the offered plea. And basically that means...
It means that you maintain your innocence, but you enter a guilty plea.
Yes.
Right.
But you maintain...
No contest plea.
You maintain your innocence, mm-hmm. but what you are waiving is the state's... or your ability to sue the state for wrongfully convicting you and keeping you in prison for 18 years.
And it allows the state to save face by saying, look, as far as we're concerned, we've got three guilty pleas. Our case is over. This case is closed.
Yep.
Yeah, because...
They get asked that in that when they plea. A journalist says, so are you going to be working to find who did this? Mm-hmm. And the guy stumbles all over it. The guy who was talking to the press, he was okay, but he was struggling. And he just said...
That was the prosecutor who accepted the offered plea from the boys.
From the boys. And he said, well, as far as we're concerned, this is... We got the right people and basically case closed. But he does say that if it did go to trial, there was a way he said it where he was like, we didn't feel like it would.
Yeah.
Then they spin it as trying to save the taxpayers a lot of money, from a lawsuit.
Yeah. They've waived their right to sue the state.
Yeah.
He mentions that in the press conference.
We're still great and benevolent, you know, even though.
Well, to their great credit, Jason Baldwin today, I don't know what Jesse Miskelly does. He's kind of disappeared. The West Memphis 3 website that was part of the second Paradise Lost film. That was when people from outside the state started to get involved and they created a website. It's WM3.org. Yep. There's not a lot on it now.
No.
But at the time, there were biographies on all three boys, and they kept a file of all their legal filings on the website, like, I guess, scanned documents of legal filings. Anyway, there was a wealth of information there at the time. But now it's just links to their social media accounts, and Jesse Miskelly does not have a social media account of any kind. Mm-hmm. The other two are on Instagram and Facebook, I believe.
Yes.
And Damien Eccles, to his credit, he has been very adamant in the years since his release about trying to keep this case alive. He said, look, there's still a killer out there.
Mm-hmm.
Why is everybody not freaking out? Why is that not the story about this? Somebody killed these three little boys and they're still out there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Dan Stidham is the same way. Dan Stidham is very upset that they took this plea.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And he says, he admits that it's for selfish reasons. He wanted his day in court. He wanted the big slap in the face to all of them, all the prosecutors, the judge, everybody to say.
Because he felt like he was going to get it.
You were wrong. Yeah. And that denied him. So he was like, I know I'm being selfish about it. Mm-hmm. But it did. This case took over Dan Stidham's life. He lost his marriage. Mm-hmm. He allowed it to utterly consume him.
Yeah. He tells a story at one point during this process. When the case first happened, his daughter was about, she was less than a year old. And a few chapters later, we get to a point in the story where Dan Stidham is telling the reader, I had to sit my 15-year-old daughter down and explain to her that people may say bad things about dad on TV. This is the point where he has to fall on his sword. And and he's helping them, he's helping the boys to write this petition. Mm-hmm. It's called the number is 37, but in the state of Arkansas, if you want to submit an appeal based on the fact that you got insufficient legal counsel.
Mm-hmm. That's where he says he falls on the sword.
Yeah, Dan Stidham actually had to help them write that. Mm-hmm. And he's throwing himself under the bus at this point.
He did.
But he had to tell his 15-year-old daughter, and he said, oh my God, that was one point when I realized how long this has been going on.
Yeah.
When it started, she was less than a year old. She was crawling in the floor, and now she's about to get her driver's license, and she's coming home crying from school every day because people are calling her dad a loser because he's fighting for these murderers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So she's having to struggle with that, and it just really, it still consumes his life, I think. He made it sound very clear in his latest interview that I listened to that he's not finished with this. He wants to know who did it.
Yeah.
He wants to have his day where they find out who did it. And and show everybody.
There's some new, one of the latest things that I saw about Damian Echols is he has recently won an appeal or won a request that went all the way up to the Arkansas State Supreme Court to have some DNA evidence released. Mm-hmm. And I don't know what it is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that they just said something about that in April.
Recently,
it?
Yeah, yeah, it was earlier this year. Because he lost the appeal to begin with. Until he pointed out an error, or his attorneys pointed out an error that was made. Mm-hmm. And it's still the prosecution in Crittenden County is fighting this. Mm-hmm. Why in the hell would you not release everything? Yeah, here's the whole box. Take
we
it.
We already know that if this you can whole figure it area, out. You all suck. We know that.
Yeah.
You're not saving any kind of face. You're just making yourself look worse.
Dumber and dumber.
I mean, I don't understand that, but you know what? I don't have to understand that. That's not my job. But I do know that when they were released, so the day that they do this plea, they walk free. Mm-hmm. They walk free.
That's right. That day. It that takes an day. Hour. They walk out.
They walk out. Free men after 18 years and
78 days.
8 days.
At this point, had spent more time in prison than they ever spent out.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And they no longer, Jason Baldwin is a grown man now. No more baby face.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. They're all in their 40s.
And that's why, Dan Stidham called this book, according to his interview, A Harvest of Innocence, is because we talk about the three victims who were 8 years old, and then you talk about these three kids who were 16, 17, and 18, who lost 18 and 78 days of their lives. Mm-hmm. Just ruined their entire lives. Of the parents of the victims, I know that eventually John Mark Byers turned and believed.
That's right.
The West Memphis. Pam Hobbs did as well.
Yeah, she started to have a lot of doubt about the guilt of the three boys who went to prison, mm-hmm. and also started to have some doubts about the innocence of Terry Hobbs. And there's one story that she tells where when she and Terry finally parted ways, I think they left after a heated argument, or they parted ways after a heated argument.
They had a pretty volatile
they did.
Relationship.
She got a hold of a lockbox that was his and she left with it because, you know, I'm taking this, it's mine. Mm-hmm. She gets home with it, cracks it open, and there's a pocket knife in the box that she knows that her father, Stevie's grandfather, gave him to carry around in his pocket. And as far as she knew, he always, every day when he grabbed his stuff.
Mm-hmm. Had that in his
pocket. He had that pocket knife with him. And for some reason, all these years later, it turns up in a locked box in Terry Hobbs's garage.
And why would it be
crawl space?
Why would it be there?
Why does he have this that I was surprised wasn't found on Stevie the day they found his body? Because I expected that to be part of what they found.
Yeah.
And all this time later, he has it the whole time.
Yeah.
Just another.
Interesting.
Yeah, I don't like it.
It. Makes him a much better suspect than the other three, but still, I wouldn't take that to trial if I were a prosecutor.
Oh, no. But again, reasonable doubt.
Reasonable doubt. Yeah, that's what we're talking about.
Oh, one last thing I'll tell you from the Dan Stidham book that I learned that I thought was interesting. There were several instances where people who would have been defense witnesses were asked by the prosecutors to leave town so they could not be served with a subpoena to testify. Like taking 50 miles away or taken across the Mississippi River into Memphis and given a hotel room for a week.
If you go to this much trouble, you're desperate.
Yeah, that's...
You're desperate.
That's insane.
There are at least two witnesses that told Stidham years later.
And also...
Oh, by the way, here's a funny story that I should have told you 20 years ago. They paid for me to stay in a hotel so you couldn't subpoena me to testify for the defense.
Why didn't those people come forward sooner?
I don't know.
That's
because they probably all had something that was being held over their heads.
Yeah.
Some little something. Because why else? I mean, if they came up to me and said, hey, I know that you know that Kelly didn't do it. And I know they're going to call you to testify next week, but here's two tickets to Disney World. Why don't you conveniently be gone?
And here's the thing. They're getting all this money and they're using all this to do this. But then Dan Stidham did not even get paid what they said they would pay him for representing Jesse Miss Kelly. So Judge Burnett and Judge Burnett would never
give
him.
He was the guy who got to decide.
Yeah. He would never give him a reason as to why it was less. He just didn't give him a reason. Refused.
There was an agreement that was made when these six lawyers were assigned to be the defense teams for Eccles, Baldwin, and Miss Kelly, there was an agreement about how much you got paid to do that. Well, it took him 2 years to get paid.
And then it was
Dan Stidham almost lost his law practice in the process. He lost his family.
Yeah.
In the process, almost lost his law firm at one point because he can't do anything else because he's consumed by this case, but he can't get paid for it. And then when he finally got paid,
it wasn't what it was supposed to be.
It wasn't what it was supposed to be. He figured it out. He got paid $21 an hour.
Oh, wow.
$21 an hour.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. It's pretty disgusting. But I'll tell you this, Dan Stidham has proven to be a person you do not want to cross because he won't let it go. Mm-hmm. He will not let it go. Yeah. But I will say this. I know we've talked a lot about his book and a lot about his interview, but you still need to get the book and read it. Mm-hmm. There's a lot.
Harvest of Innocence from 2013. It's a recent book. It just came out last year.
Yes. And check out his interview with True Crime Garage. You can hear it from him. You can hear his answers. And
was he still heated in the interview, or had he kind of calmed down?
He's calm.
Okay.
He's very calm when he's answering the questions, but the determination and the disdain is still there.
Right. Yeah.
But he's calm and he's answering, and he's able to laugh at some of the just ridiculousness of it, but it's a very good interview. Okay. So I would recommend this book and this interview for everybody to listen to. So that's good.
Yeah, as far as we go with this, because we're the 101 version.
We are the 101 version, but present day, they're out.
Yes.
They're doing their thing. You can't find Jesse Miss Kelly on social media. You can't find Miss Kelly.
Baldwin is, he's somebody who he's involved in, like, it's something like the Innocence Project. I mean, he's a speaker.
He wants to be
a
lawyer, but he can't because it would take an Arkansas governor pardoning them for him to be able to do that.
He'd never pass character.
But Dan Stidham is hopeful that an Arkansas governor will eventually pardon them.
And for what it's worth, Dan Stidham, and I happen to agree with Dan Stidham on this, I think a serial killer.
Oh, yeah. Okay, so we didn't get to
that
part. Kill
those boys.
So Scott is, and tell us why. Tell us why you think that, Scott.
Well, because of the randomness of the crime. Well, it seems random. I know that John Douglas believes that somebody who knew the boys
was
guilty.
You just
or that's
tell
his
us,
best theory.
Yeah, but why do you think?
But the randomness of it, the proximity to this, one of the busiest intersections, interstate areas in the country, where 40 and 55 cross
that
right there in West Memphis.
You've actually been there.
Been there, and it's, you know,
but
it's,
you weren't there
it's
on
a madhouse.
You weren't there.
I was there 2 years later.
Yeah.
Just to be clear.
Because it's a witch hunt.
Yeah. I was drunk in Tuscaloosa the night this happened. It was a Wednesday, right? Yeah, I was drunk in Tuscaloosa.
Cinco de Mayo.
Yes, it was. I'm sure I was drunk in Tuscaloosa. But it's just, I think that's it, as plausible an excuse as anything. Mm-hmm. There's a couple of mentions in Dan Stidham's book about similar murders of similar aged children within a couple of hundred miles, within a couple of years.
Wow. And that's good.
That
that's
nobody
good
has
work.
Ever followed up on.
That's good work, actually. That's, but, you know, so I think that's very interesting. And I hope he keeps on with that. And I hope it gets the
there were at least two other children around the same age who were killed by bludgeoning and left like in a body of water.
Okay. So see, that's very similar.
I mean, that was similar enough for everybody to figure out that the Zodiac killer was the same guy, even though he killed a different way every time.
Yeah. Also, very interesting, the bodies of the three boys didn't have any mosquito bites on them. And we've already talked about how bad the mosquitoes are in Arkansas and how bad they were then, which leads a lot of people to believe that they could have been killed somewhere else. And right there with that truck stop, you back up one of those big trucks, big long truck is a trailer. Yeah. Big long. I mean, there's a lot of room in there.
And we mentioned this last week. The way the boys' bodies were tied,
they could be carried.
It would make it easy to get your hand, one big person to get his hand under both sets of ligatures and carry.
Yeah, you could carry two at a time.
That's right. Like 40 pounds a piece.
The way they were tied up, it would have been like they would have been like luggage.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
Like a carry-on bag or something. But so that they could easily be. But that was very, they found that very interesting as far as, and that's what leads, that supports your theory.
Reasonable doubt.
Yeah, definitely.
Just
definitely.
More. And now you start to see why this new judge was going to grant this motion for a new trial.
I don't think there was a question. I think this guy was going to
There was a lot.
Do it. Another fun fact. Well, it's not. It's fun to watch in Paradise Lost, the third one, is when you see the defense team presenting their stuff to the Arkansas Supreme Court.
Yes.
And they do this great job. They have this really great lawyer who
That's the guy from San Francisco.
Yeah. And he knows exactly how to talk to the Supreme Court.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. He's very respectful. But he's making very good points that they're thinking about. And you can tell by their questions that, they say, okay, well, what?
Yeah.
The way they're asking their questions, you can tell they're agreeing with him. And this is the guy that's representing the three guys to get them out. And so then the state brings their guy up there, who is he's like the lead assistant attorney general or something like that. He's got a big long title. He is so ill-equipped to deal with this Supreme Court.
Yeah.
They ask him, they say, what would it hurt to bring this into light? Mm. If he had been walking and tripping as much as he was tripping over his words.
Oh, he'd have killed himself.
He would not have a bone in his body that's not broken. Mm-hmm. He tripped over.
Yeah.
His mouth was so dry, it was making me disgusted.
His argument was basically, if we let them bring in this new evidence, you are tinkering with the finality of justice.
The finality of justice.
And so in the state's eyes, again, what only matters to the state is, we have found somebody guilty. And we are not at fault because we are incapable of...
And the defense
failing to do this properly the first time. So to even question us is ridiculous.
Well, and then he starts saying, and you must look at it this way, and you must look, you have to, and you, and I'm thinking, are you really saying that to the Supreme Court? And then the defense lawyer says, to not look at this would be saying that the state is perfect in their process and conviction and making them divine.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh my gosh, he brought in, they're going to use Satan to convict them. They just use God to get them out. It was fantastic.
Well, that was the famous quote from Jason Baldwin at one point when he said, it took one false confession to get us in jail. And it took another false confession to get us out. And that's what happened.
Yeah, exactly. So...
Okay, we're going to need a palate cleanser after this three-part
this has
series.
Been rough,
and I've got an idea. I've told you about it, and I know you hate it when I give things away.
Okay.
But we're going to do something fun with amusement parks coming up soon.
We are.
I've found three stories that are very good.
Are they fun
we're gonna
or
cram
not?
Them. It's a true crime podcast,
it's
Kelly.
It's true crime.
Yeah, it's going to be a crime.
We're just,
But I've found three really good stories. They're all kind of short, so I'm gonna squeeze them all together into one episode at some point down the road this summer, since it'll be summertime and we're all thinking about going to amusement parks and roller coasters and whatnot. And we're gonna have a conversation about roller coasters when we do that. I've already thought of the question I'm gonna ask both of you, so be mulling that over.
I'll be prepared.
Okay. All right, guys. So don't forget to say something nice about us on your podcast platform of choice. 5 stars on Apple iTunes works great for the three of us. And don't forget to leave your name so we can give you a shout out on the show. And if you give us a review and you don't leave your name, we're going to give you a shout down on the show. So don't fall into that hole. Facebook, Instagram. I don't like Twitter anymore, so I'm not updating Twitter anymore. But you can follow us there if you like. You guys got anything else?
That's not.
Is that it?
Yeah.
Good night, everybody.